Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Well, hey, folks, today we're diving into a question that's been on my mind for several years, and that's why do so many women like true crime stories? And why do they show such fascination for serial predators? True crime is more than a genre. It's a cultural phenomenon. And if you've wondered why women in particular are drawn to these chilling and mysterious tales, then you've come to the right place, because we're going to unravel the layers of this fascinating phenomenon right now. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Profiling Evil. I'm Mike, and it's great to see you all coming in. You know, I worried a little bit about this topic because it's not as sensational as all the murders that are going on and the intrigue that's going on. But I thought it was pretty dang important because I kept kind of noodling through it. So anyway, here we are, and let's have some conversation tonight. I want to shout out to folks that are on the screen already. Honey Hush, thank you. I did make it. Margaret Hutchins, thanks to the mods tonight. Shannon Begley. Let's see. Why do men like true crime? Yeah, I think you might be statistically you are a minority in this one. Ziggy played guitar. Hey, JoJo Wynn's on tonight. You're going to actually see her in the video. And I want you to know, she is an incredibly brave human being. She actually has Bell's palsy, and when you listen to her, you might catch that. You never see it because she's typing all the time. But we're going to hear from her, as well as another couple of Profiling Evil folks who sent in some information. Diane Phoenix, hi. Mandy Schwab, hello. Gosh, everyone, thanks so much for jumping in. We're going to talk about this issue that I have been thinking about for an awfully long time. Now, some of this is pre-recorded. Obviously, this is live. So if I'm dressed up, it's pre-recorded. If I'm a bum like this with the fire going, then it's live. So Dimples says, I fit into this category. Elaine Weldon, I'm sorry. Loves Dr. Doss, and we're gonna have a couple of amazing people on with me tonight. Dr. Doss is sound asleep right now, so we're not going to hear from him. Dr. Johnston is tied up, but we will be able to fill in any chat kinds of things, and they'll be checking in, and maybe even during the live come on and weigh in a little bit, but only if Dr. Dawes is up in the middle of the night with a sick child or something, we might see him. But anyway, let's dig into this. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Profiling Evil. And as we jump into the gripping twists and turns of this question, don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button and ring the bell so that you're getting all of our notifications when videos like this one come out. Now, this one's pretty special, so make sure you're capturing it. And we're going to be looking now into the mysteries of the human psyche as it comes to true crime.
Hello, Clarice.
Not many people will forget the first time they saw Silence of the Lambs. Well, today, we're going to delve into the psychological aspects of why true crime narratives seem to be more attractive to women than men. In fact, many statistics suggest that more than 80% of you listening right now are probably women.
As part of our discussion, and since Profiling Evil is watched by people all over the world, I felt like I should ask an expert in another country about their opinions on this matter. So I want to turn some time over to comments by Dr. Soham Das, a forensic psychiatrist out of England. Now, Dr. Das has spent much of his career working with some of England's most disturbed criminals. Hey, Doc, thanks for joining me today on Profiling Evil.
Mr. King, hello again. Always a pleasure to collaborate with you, sir.
Well, several times during my video and on videos in the past, I've mentioned this high proportion of women who seem to be drawn to this genre. Statistically, pretty widely, it suggests that more than 80% of true crime viewers are more likely to be women rather than men. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on these numbers.
So I think there's a few different reasons why women in general are more interested in true crime statistically than men. It's certainly something that I see. So for example, I will speak at these true crime conventions and the audience overwhelmingly is female. I think probably the most obvious one to me is vulnerability and safety. So women are much more likely statistically to experience violence and harassment from men. So from the women's perspective, engaging with true crime stories, particularly those with female victims, is a way to kind of conceptualize and understand and grapple with these threats, as well as learning coping mechanisms and just sort of generally feeling prepared. I suppose another kind of reason, another connection is empathy and just general emotional connectivity. So it's no secret, studies have shown that women generally score higher in terms of empathy rating scales than men. And true crime narratives often delve into this like personal experience of the victims and also their families. So I think that's more likely to resonate strongly with women's naturally empathetic natures compared to men. And I suppose another connection that men are probably statistically less interested in true crime than women is social expectations and gender roles. So women traditionally have been socialized or brought up to be nurturing and caregiving, whereas generally men are conditioned to be like more brave, more stoic, more detached, more kind of emotionally cold, more aggressive even, I think, in some societies. So I think these gender roles might influence how they interact with emotionally charged content like true crime. So it might be more appealing for women who are more naturally nurturing, is what I'm trying to say. And then finally, probably a slightly more subtle reason, I think, is representation. So the true crime genre is increasingly featuring female protagonists, both as investigators and in victims, but I would say also perpetrators. So even though by far more men commit violence and offences than women, more true crime is focusing on women just because I think they want a different angle. So women see themselves, or people in general, are more likely to gravitate towards something where they see themselves being represented.
Dr. Das, I've shared my experiences before of interviewing serial killers like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, and my amazement, utter amazement at times, at the number of women who want to have a relationship with people like this. Why are they doing it?
Okay, Mike, so what you're talking about actually has a specific name. So we psychiatrists, we like to make ourselves sound cleverer than we actually are. And the name for that, for women who want to have a relationship with dangerous people like serial killers, is hybristophilia. And there's lots of different reasons. I think from my clinical experience, it's a bit of an uncomfortable truth, but a lot of these women have their own history of trauma, either physically, sexually, or emotionally abused by a parent or by a previous partner. So I think that they subconsciously gravitate towards letting the cycle repeat themselves. So what I'm saying is they gravitate towards what's familiar instead of what is more safe or what's more logical. Ironically, I think that some of these women feel that they can have safer relationships with killers, for example, because their partners are behind bars. So the women get to control and get to dominate, and they have some power in the relationship dynamic, possibly for the first time ever, because they've had a string of abusive relationships. So specifically, the woman is on the outside, the man's in prison, she gets to call the shots, she gets to make decisions such as visiting hours and giving him items, etc., etc. She knows where he is at all times. And I think kind of connected to that, a lot of women that come from these damaged relationships, they have this notion of the idealized relationship. So they don't have to endure the regular mundane issues like, you know, washing his dirty socks, but they get the excitement of having the relationship with this kind of controversial but potentially quite stimulating and exciting individual. And I have to say that another big reason, I think, is the savior complex. So some women have this overpowering, nurturing and motherly instinct. And maybe it's because of their own history. Maybe they were smothered by their own parents, or maybe their parents forced their moral framework onto them. So from their perspective, they want a challenge to as part of the savior complex. And what bigger challenge is there? What more damaged evil man can you heal than a killer or a serial killer? And it's a bit uncomfortable, but I have to be honest, I think it's in a minority of cases, another reason why some women are attracted to serial killers or murderers is just related to celebrity worship. Again, it's a small proportion, but I've definitely seen, and I'm sure you have, Mike, some people who seem to have done this relationship because they want to share the media spotlight. You know, they get a book deal or a movie deal. And I think what's happening there is they're conflating being infamous and being famous. And even outside of, you know, hybristophilia, I think that it is a general phenomenon that's happened recently in terms of social media. You see these TV reality stars, you see people becoming famous without any discernible skill. They're just famous for the sake of it. And I think that's all connected to wanting to be famous by association with somebody who's infamous.
Will you never disappoint, Dr. Doss? I'd like to take a moment and have you tell everybody where they can catch you on your YouTube channel and follow you. So please, folks, follow Dr. Doss. I mean, I certainly do, and I think you're going to really enjoy his content.
So, Mike, it would be a pleasure to see some of your viewers on my YouTube channel, A Psych for Sore Minds. I cover a smorgasbord of topics related to mental illness and criminality because my job is a forensic psychiatrist. I assess mentally disordered offenders for a living. So recently I've done some celebrity cases like the mental health of Dr. Dre, of Jada Pinkett Smith and her threats of suicide. And I've done some high profile true crime cases. A huge case in my country was Lucy Letby. So she's a nurse who was quite recently convicted and imprisoned of killing multiple babies on her ward. I'm sure some of your viewers would have heard of that case. Mike, always a pleasure, and let's do it again sometime.
So let's stop there for a minute. I've been reading some of the comments. Some are making me kind of smile. Kind of weigh in on where you fit on that scale of Dr. Doss's opinions of why women prefer true crime over men. And then if you got some questions, maybe we can field those as we go along. Dr. Doss is such a great guy. In fact, we were talking today, and we are going to do something on Lucy Letby, and we'll figure all that out at some particular point. But anyway, yeah, a whole bunch of you just scratching your head over this idea of marrying a serial killer. You know, I remember asking Richard Ramirez that very question. He was receiving at that time more than 300 letters per month from women all around the world who wanted to be with him, and they sent some pretty disgusting ways in which they wanted to be with him. And it was this kind of celebrity status. There were a few where you could kind of sense that maybe they thought they could rescue and fix or change. But what are your thoughts on that? Is he hitting the nail on the head, or is he just completely crazy? Let's see. Terry says, I can relate to some of them, but stop very short of being associated with a serial killer. Yeah. this one, I'm missing the conversation here. My wife painted the outside of our new house with indoor wall paint. That's probably a story I've missed altogether. Good to see you folks all piling in here and the comments that you're firing. JoJo's asking, is your interview with Ramirez on the PE website? Actually, no, the interview with Ramirez is not on the website, but my comments and some of my experiences with Richard back when I was working for the Attorney General, I was interviewing serial killers all across the country as part of a study that Greg Cooper and I were doing for the Bureau of Justice. And so we ate a lot of prison lasagna with a lot of people that are whacked out. And by the way, if you want my prison lasagna recipe, go to mappingevil.com or no, go to Mapping Evil with Mike King, and mappingevil.com will get you there. So anyway, you can get that. Let's see. Bogart for Adventures says, love true crime and your shows. Oh, that's from Meg. Thanks, Meg. And then Bogart said, marrying jailbirds is some strange kind of codependency. Crazy. And yeah, C. Taylor, nothing like prison lasagna with a serial killer. You have quite an interesting conversation over some prison food. So anyway, let's dig into this a little further. As you can tell, for those of you that might be tuning in, I recorded pieces of this because I interviewed quite a few different people for this one. I felt like it was really important. It's not going to get big numbers like if we were talking about Rex Heurman tonight. But I think over the long haul, it will be one that people will continually come back and look at. So please share it with your friends and pass the good word along. And make sure you're hitting the thumbs up and stuff. That really does help us. Let's see. Dimples says, I have no fascination with serial killers. I'm a people watcher and have lived a quiet life. Yeah. Leslie says they are so weird and foreign serial killers. So it's the obscurity, I think. The rest of these women might be something about the bad boy thing. That's kind of interesting. This one is actually keep up the chatter. I'm just a junkie for true crime. So we'll see what's going on here. Margaret says the case that interested me after I moved to the area was Jody Holson-Truitt. I don't know that one. Missing person case. Anyway, here's one from Sandy Wright. I related to the fact that I was abused as a kid. And so both of Sandy's husbands were abusers trying to break that chain of abuse. Yeah, I'm so sorry that you went through that. So keep the conversation going amongst you, and let's jump back into this.
Remember, you can find Dr. Doss on A Psych for Sore Minds, and make sure that you subscribe. It's one of my favorite channels. So there you go. Doc, thanks so much for your friendship and your expertise. I look forward to having you back on Profiling Evil. I really appreciate the professionals that I have the opportunity to rub shoulders with. I thought it would be interesting to start across the pond with Dr. Doss, but now move into a little deeper discussion with Dr. Joni Johnson. Austin.
You'll notice that my attire changes a little bit because I've done the interviews a couple of days ago and I'm now getting everything pieced together. But let's watch this together. Well, folks, I'm joined today by my good friend, Dr. Joni Johnston. Dr. Johnston's a clinical forensic psychologist and a licensed private investigator. She has more than 30 years of clinical forensic experience as a therapist and an evaluator. And plus she's also got that investigative background. And Joni, it's always my honor just to be able to rub shoulders with you. So welcome to Profiling Evil.
Thank you so much. What a great start for me for the new year, Mike, to be able to be on your show.
Well, I appreciate it. I know you have family and it's the end of the year, but thanks so much for doing it. You know, I wanted to play a couple of video clips as we get started from some of the Profiling Evil channel members. I reached out in an email and I just said, would anyone like to share their thoughts on a couple of primary questions? And the questions were, I think, pretty simple. I mean, I asked them if they'd ever been victimized. I asked why they watch true crime. And then I kind of closed it all out with, what have you learned from this experience? And so if you're okay, I'm going to just pop these up and we'll listen. And
the main reason that I get fascinated with them is I used to be a police officer one time. And by doing that, of course, you know, it's a drama field, an action field. And it kind of fills up that area for me since I'm not in that field anymore. Haven't been since the late 70s. But we didn't have a lot of that stuff back in the late 70s that we could work on. So now it's interesting to see what they use to be able to apprehend the the suspects that they have in the case. And
I think what it was is what happened to me early teens. It didn't happen to me directly, but I had two friends. One was abducted off the street in Liverpool in New South Wales and was taken away and unfortunately assaulted. That really had a big impact on me as a young person. And from then on, I just had that big interest in crime.
I think really started when I became aware that an individual could, totally unrelated to a crime, could make a difference in solving that crime. And that became evident to me when I first started watching. I watched from the very first episode, Most Wanted with John Walsh, and subsequent episodes would show that some tipster had called in and a perpetrator was caught. And then time after time, that might be the case. Not only did it heighten my awareness that an individual could make a difference, it also heightened my awareness of how many criminals were out there for that to happen. So that's what got me started down this rabbit hole of true crime.
Well, Dr. Johnston, I mean, you've listened to these women in part, and I just wondered what kind of thoughts you had on this.
Well, there are so many interesting comments that each of your guests shared, and I can relate to some of them, and I think the research supports some of them. So, you know, for example, you know, one of the things that one of your interviewees said was that, you know, this kind of thrill, vicarious experience. There is an adrenaline part, I think, of watching true crime, and oftentimes that gets lost because there's so much talk about why do women like to watch true crime because they're often victims, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there is a part of that that is kind of a, you know, a way to kind of get excitement in a limited kind of safe way that is true for a lot of people, not, you know, not just women, but certainly we know that true crime seems to fascinate women more than men. I also think that there is for sure the safety issue that a lot of women, I think, you know, I've seen some studies that suggest that women watch true crime for that reason. That is not my experience and isn't the experience of most people I know, but I do think it's a very important secondary component, you know, to look in. I've certainly, you know, seen a lot of things and learned a lot of things myself. I've got two teenage daughters and I've bombarded them at times with safety information, some of which came from watching some of the true crime shows. So I think this idea of multiple reasons for watching true crime, I think is very, very important. The whole idea, I think, of empowerment, because not only in terms of women watching true crime, but how they watch true crime. I think sometimes it's more like a lot of women study true crime. And I think the relationship that many women have had with true crime has changed. It's become much more interactive, much more about solving crime, much more about empowerment, much more about victim advocacy than maybe that was the case, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so, you know, one of your viewers said that, you know, that she got interested in it when she realized she can make a difference. And we've seen that women have made a difference. And a lot of the podcasters are women, for example, and they are always talking about advocacy and about if you see something, say something, and just, you know, there's all the sleuthing groups and citizen detectives and those kinds of things. So I do think the relationship between true crime, you know, with women and the viewers has really changed over time. And so I think it's become in some respects empowering. And I also think this issue of women kind of banding together to help each other is something that sometimes gets lost when we're talking about true crime. Because, you know, in some respects, when you listen to some of these podcasts and you have people who are making fun of the perpetrators, for example, or talking about them in that way, and then talking about the survivors and how brave they are, many more survivors are coming forward. You're having family members of serial killers who, you know, 30 years ago probably would have run away, changed their name, kind of been somehow felt like they were guilty in addition to that, who are now coming out and becoming advocates for victims. So I do think that, you know, as odd as it sounds to some extent, it really has become an empowering thing for many women who watch true crime, who feel much more engaged and much more supported by that community.
You know, I want you to know, Joni, I'm really getting excited because already some of my impressions are evolving. And I hope that's what's happening with people that are listening, is that they're not just stuck in a rut with their own belief system, but they're willing to be educated and learn and experience other people's perspective and grow from it. Folks, I'm talking with Dr. Joni Johnston, a clinical and forensic psychologist, and we're talking about this topic of women having a higher propensity to be engaged in viewing true crime stories than men. And, you know, Joni, I've had the honor of teaching criminal profiling and criminal investigative analysis around the world. In fact, you serve on the Cold Case Foundation with my dear friend Greg, who is my mentor. And those experiences included opportunities to speak on the investigative process in places like Saudi Arabia or Europe or Asia. And as I've done that, and frankly, even speaking of Greg, as we've sat and signed books in locations for people, I've been kind of surprised at the demographic who stood in line to buy our books and get our signatures. And usually, you know, it's 25 to 70 year old women. And when I look at the demographic of Profiling Evil, it's high 80%. So Dr. Johnston, with that, I mean, seeing this high number of women, I guess my question is, from first blush, why do you think there are just so many more women engaged in the true crime genre?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, we have a reputation as women. And of course, we're all completely diverse and different. And so you might ask, you know, 15 women and get 15 different answers. But I do think we oftentimes share some common experiences. One of them being that we're certainly much more likely to be victimized sexually, for example. And so I think there is a common concern there. I think that there is certainly an opportunity when we, you know, we watch shows where women have been victimized, and particularly women who survive and family members who survive, and they come on and they talk about it, and we learn what to do. We learn how to stay safe. We learn what it's like to recover. We learn that it's not the end, you know, that being a victim does not mean it's the end of your life. It can oftentimes be the beginning of a different way of viewing life and a way of engaging with life and engaging with people. You know, we also learn how to act, yeah, I think, advocate for ourselves. I mean, I'm amazed at how many women contact me and they're, you know, feeling frustrated. There's a case that's not moving forward. There's a perception that they're not being heard. And they're, you know, used to be kind of wanting to just kind of emote, you know, or vent about it. And I think there's been this transition where it's becoming, okay, what route should I take? Should I hire a private investigator? Should I go to the media? You know, how do I kind of take control of this? And so I think there's that part of it, that women are becoming more educated. And true crime has been helpful in that way, to educate them about crime, educate them about investigation, educate them about what to do if you are a victim, how to not be a victim. And so I think there's a huge educational component, which some of your people who sit in videos were talking about, that educating your former police officer was talking about learning about different investigative techniques. Well, I think a lot of women are engaged in that. And then we have this, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the citizen detective kind of approach. So I think what initially I think was seen, you know, I think 20 years ago, it was kind of like, why are women watching true crime, you know, where women are primarily victims? Do they want to be victims? Are they interested? And it's like, no, I think it's the exact opposite for many women. They are not wanting to be victims, and they're wanting to find out, how do I not be a victim? And what do I do if I am a victim? And how can I help other victims? How can I solve crimes? How can I be an active, engaged part of the community? I have a voice when I'm in the true crime community that maybe I don't feel like I have as much with my local police department, who I might feel like isn't listening to me Or is it moving things forward? I think the other thing is, certainly with the internet, we are seeing more examples of excellent police work, and we're seeing more examples of, you know, people feeling victim blamed or whatever. And I think that also has energized a lot of people, you know, not just women, but we're talking about women in true crime. So I think it's very complicated when we talk about, I mean, I remember becoming a true crime. And let me also just say that there is, of course, this interest in people. And I think that, you know, a lot of women think of themselves as being very interested in relationships and being interested in interpersonal interactions. And when you watch, I mean, that's what true crime is when you're watching it on a podcast or a TV show. It's about the stories, right? It's about the interactions between the individuals. It's about the relationship dynamics between husband and wife that ends up in murder. It's about those kinds of things. And so I think there is this natural curiosity about how do relationships work? And also, how do I apply this extreme situation where somebody does end up being murdered to my own life? Are there things I need to watch out for when I'm dating somebody that are red flags? So there's just, I think, so many opportunities and so many components of watching true crime, as long as it doesn't become, you know, all consuming. And as long as I think the engagement and the advocacy doesn't turn into, as we've unfortunately seen, you know, times when innocent people got blamed or those kinds of things. But I think there's a lot of positives for that.
That's really a powerful statement, because one of the things I found that's interesting is recently we saw a social influencer who was consumed with watching true crime and eventually felt like they needed to act it out. The fantasy or whatever they were getting from that wasn't good enough, and they had to act it out. And I often say to the folks that watch Profiling Evil is step away and watch some puppy films or something, you know, and make sure you're getting the balance in life as you look at these, because it is a deep, dark subject, and these stories have taken the world by storm. I can't believe the number of programs now that have gone to just showing true crime documentaries. And while the stories might be captivating and suspenseful, they're real life events. And again, it seems demographically that women seem to listen more. And I wrote a couple of things down early on, knowing that I was going to talk to you, of reasons I feel like women primarily view true crime. And that, again, that's statistically everything I've read and been able to see in articles, and how they did it, I'm not sure, is about 80%. But I'd like to maybe just run those reasons by you and get your response. Yeah, you game for that?
Absolutely.
Okay. But I believe that women explore these true crime stories from the comfort of their home or their mobile devices or even their car radios on podcasts, because it gives them a chance to explore the dark side of humanity in a really safe environment. And I wondered about it, if observing these horrific events in some way kind of gets the heart pounding without increasing the risk. What are your thoughts?
I absolutely agree with you. You know, I don't think every person who watches true crime would agree with that, but I think a lot of them would, because it is a safe way of getting that blood pumping. It is in some respects a vicarious way, right, of experiencing a horrific event. And I think the challenge, as you pointed out, Mike, is to realize that this is not like a movie. These are real people that have been hurt and devastated. So that's, I think, the trick. But absolutely, you know, to the extent that it provides this kind of heart pumping, you know, tense experience in a safe way, I think, you know, we can all relate to that. As you can see in my background, I've got a picture of It and a picture of Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, I absolutely, you know, I love scary movies. I like horror movies. I like experiencing that adrenaline. You know, I don't know that was a primary reason I became interested in true crime at age 14. I think for me, it really was the sense of, you know, wanting to understand, you know, how can people do these things? You know, how can somebody, particularly somebody, a stranger, just decide they want to go out and murder somebody and just pick somebody off the streets and do horrible things to them. It was something I just completely could not understand and really wanted just to have dedicated my life to some extent to understand that. I like to think I'm closer to understanding that, but there are some things that I always tell, you know, my audience that there's some things that we might be able to intellectually understand that we're never going to emotionally understand because it just doesn't compute, you know, we just can't relate to it on any kind of emotional level.
You know, that's interesting because it makes me think I've taken a few hits here and there when I've expressed compassion toward not just victims, but perpetrators and extended family. And oftentimes people can get pretty judgmental and pretty aggressive. But how have those kinds of feelings impacted you as you've dealt with the very worst in a clinical setting with the victims who have suffered the very worst of offenses against them? And how do you keep that balance?
It is an ongoing challenge. I mean, I feel so lucky, Mike, that I've been able to work with perpetrators as well as victims. I encourage everybody who contacts me, who's a budding forensic psychologist or interested in that, you know, I always tell them you need to do both because, you know, one of the things my mom used to always tell me is, you know, few people are as bad as the worst thing they've done, and there are few people are as good as the best. You know, and be sure that you keep that in mind and realize every person's different and try to understand that person's story. Now, there are some horrific things that I could never excuse and would never can even explain. But having worked, you know, inside of a maximum security prison and worked with inmates and then having worked with victims and just seeing the trauma, what's so ironic to me is that some of the times I feel like in some cases, I could take the childhoods and mix them up and you couldn't tell if this was a perpetrator's background or a victim's background because there was such trauma in that past. And so, you know, one of the challenges for me as a forensic psychologist and, you know, a lifelong challenge, and I'm sure it will go on long after I leave this earth, is trying to figure out why do some people have horrible things happen to them and duplicate that, replicate that, or try to outdo it. And other people take those experiences and become compassionate individuals and become advocates and become, you know, good moms, good dads, and that kind of thing. And what is that? What is the difference? How can we capture, you know, that part that helps people, you know, not go down that same path? Because oftentimes they start out very, and I can always have compassion for the child, you know, that person was.
Yeah, that's really something, isn't it? To look back at before they became bad and before they became evil. And I don't know if you watch that show Hoarders, but I tune into that every once in a while and I watch it. And there's always a pivotal moment where something snaps, some loss occurs or something that seems to be consistent with the behavioral changes. I think of sitting with Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, and him telling me about having what he thought was a pretty normal childhood. He's 10, 11 years old, and then all of a sudden his cousin comes home from the war and starts sharing photographs with him of victims that he's killed in Vietnam. And he's kind of at this pubescent period where he's easily aroused and that starts his journey down this pathway of evil. You know, I'd love to think that most of us would say, you know, holy cow, that's bad and I'm not going to do that. But I think all of us deal with that. We talk about it sometimes, that secret side of our personality that delves a little bit into the darkness. And thankfully, most of us are equipped well enough in our lifetimes that we run when those kinds of things happen and we bury those thoughts.
It's so true, you know, and in interviewing many people who've been inside prison for many, many years, oftentimes there are these turning points that they can talk about, you know, that, and again, it's much more complicated than, you know, my life was on this great track and then all of a sudden one thing happened and I went completely derailed. It often, I think, was a perfect storm. But there was this last cloud or lightning strike or whatever that tended to kind of, you know, this person's at a turning point and they go down the wrong path. And so it is so easy to be judgmental, and we should completely judge the acts. There's no question about that, the things that are done. But I think from an individual standpoint, it is complicated oftentimes.
Yeah. I did a podcast. I don't know if I've ever shared this with you, but in Southeast Asia called Mapping Evil with Mike King. And as part of that, we actually, people were so amazed in Australia that I would go into the prison system back when I was still working and sit down with these serial predators and eat prison lasagna. We actually, if you go to Mapping Evil, we actually have a really nice prison lasagna recipe on there for anybody that wants to know. But it's a remarkable experience to sit with someone who is so cold, and then to sit with those same types of personalities that when you ask them 30 years later, like I did on a video I did for Profiling Evil just a few months ago on a ritual murderer, to have them say, no, I'd absolutely do the same thing again, with just such cold and calloused response. What have been some of those chilling moments for you?
Yeah, I could think of a couple of people that I worked with or met when I was working. Wow, it's just kind of hard to even, you know, even talk about it.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, one of the things that seemed to be so consistent with many of these, at least serial predators that I dealt with, I'd love your comment on this, is how in many cases they're actually pretty likable when you're talking to them across from a table. They're pretty charismatic, but it's the longer you visit with them, the more darkness you start to see. What are your thoughts in that regard?
I think that's definitely true to some extent. I mean, I think that sometimes when, you know, we're first meeting somebody, we don't understand what's underneath all that. And I think that that's, you know, sometimes when that cupboard gets lifted, what's underneath that, I think, is just gets darker and darker. And that's the part, I think, sometimes it's so often hidden that we don't see. And that's this idea that people on the outside are so charming or whatever, but what's underneath that? And that's the part, I think, that's, it's so hard to find out and so hard to see. I'm thinking about some of the couple of people I saw in, when I was working with inmates. You know, it was almost the coldness that was the scariest part, because there were a lot of inmates who had a lot of, you know, problems with impulse control and all kinds of things. But there's a whole nother level when you're talking about just a lack of emotion and a lack of kind of empathy or caring. And that is that's the scariest part to me, not the emotional kind of part, but just the cold kind of lack of caring, lack of emotion, lack of, you can't find something to hold on to or care about.
Let me bring up another thing that I jotted down, and that was my impression that women are attracted to these crime stories because it's also a way of empowering them. It reminds us to maybe stay alert and cautious in our daily lives. And I think some of these horror stories you and I have talked about before, or that we see on shows, when we view these, I believe there's a little bit of a prioritization of our own safety. And I find myself often reminding visitors to continually assess their level of risk that they're willing to take, but also asking, you know, why they allow themselves to get into some positions. And I think of this need often to be aware of our surroundings and the difference between men and women. And I've shared this personal event several times, but I remember one night walking out of the mall with my wife, and it was dark, and I don't know, I'd been a police officer maybe 25 years at the time. And she turns to me and she says, "Hey, what are you thinking about?" And I'm like, "I don't know, maybe we should grab a burger on the way home or something like that." And I was just shocked when she said, "You know, what a woman thinks about when they leave the mall is they look at where their car's parked. They look if it's dark or light. They look if there are people around that or people in between where they are." A completely different mindset. What are your thoughts there?
I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think this idea of safety, this idea of vulnerability, and you know, potential for victimization is something that clouds almost everything most women do. That we're just constantly looking at that, worried about that, thinking about that. And I think, you know, most men, it's completely different. I mean, not completely different, I guess, but very, very different. I mean, that just seems, I mean, it's the kind of thing to me that always shocks me when I realize it, because I think it's like we grow up, certainly as women, worrying about that and being concerned about that and, you know, trying to watch and we're just, there's just a lot of messages, about, you know, being safe and that in some respects that it's your responsibility to be safe. You know, whether that's fair or not, I think that's something that does kind of come up. Who's responsible?
That's a really powerful point is nobody, regardless of what happens, deserves to be victimized. But we do lend to the increase of our own personal safety by decisions we make.
We do. We absolutely do. I mean, there's no question that there are things I could do that are going to increase my risk or things I can do to decrease my risk. That's definitely true. But we were just talking about, you're absolutely right, that our actions do, you know, that our actions are important and that we can do things that are going to up the risk and do things that can decrease the risk. There's no question about that. But I think the other part of that too sometimes is who's responsible. I mean, is it responsibility? Certainly there's a responsibility of staying as safe as possible. And then there's obviously the responsibility not to do certain things, you know, not to. And so I think that's another thing that I'm always kind of trying to balance is, you know, is making sure that we understand both sides of that.
I really like that comment by our listener that we viewed at the beginning of this when she said, never allow someone to take you to a secondary location. And I'm thinking of people that go and meet people in the bar and then there's this discussion, let's go somewhere else. Or someone in the sex trade industry that is willing to go someplace where perhaps they have a gut feeling this isn't the best. I don't know. But folks, I'm talking with Dr. Joni Johnston, a clinical and forensic psychologist who happens to be an expert on criminal behavior as well. And we're talking about this phenomenon of true crime binging, and we're exploring some of the reasons of why women statistically seem more attracted to the genre than men. So welcome to Profiling Evil. And for those of you who have been with us since we started this discussion, just stick around as we continue to unravel these mysteries. Now, Dr. Johnston, the fourth reason that I wanted to kind of pitch here was I was reading an article the other day with great interest about the influx of true crime podcasts and the emergence of them in recent years. But the article suggested that another reason women in particular like these true crime stories is that it satisfies their curiosity in some way, provides adrenaline rushes, which we've already talked about. But it's also a way that they can learn some ways to investigate or figure out on that online dating service how they can get more information. And I'm actually going to be interviewing a really impressive journalist as part of this discussion that we're having, who wrote an article on that very subject of how these women are turning into amateur FBI agents investigating the backgrounds of people that they're dating online. But what's your impression of that?
I mean, it's astonishing to see them, just the complete mushrooming of women in particular, I think, who are becoming citizen detectives, armchair sleuths, whatever you want to call them, that are out there, you know, I mean, investigating everything. I mean, just in watching shows and reading about investigative techniques and sharing tips with each other, creating true crime communities. I think that is one of the most exciting and different things that I've observed in the past 20 years in the true crime space. And I think that part of it, as I've kind of mentioned a little bit before, that part of it, I think is empowering, as long as we put that in perspective. And again, we're not, you know, starting to accuse people because there's a rumor or that kind of thing. There has to be ethics involved in it. But I do think absolutely that women have kind of gone from becoming true crime consumers to true crime studiers and true crime, you know, sleuths and all kinds of things and advocates and all kinds of stuff. So I think that the active role that women are taking in true crime is really astonishing to me. It's just, you know, it just is an active role that I'm just seeing. And I think, again, for the most part, that is a very much a positive a thing. And then of course we hear of cases where a woman started a podcast and somebody who's wrongfully convicted, or, I mean, there's just the real world consequences. These things really are, you know, they're valid and they're important.
And we have millions of views out there. People are coming in. And as I watch the chat, I see a community of people, mostly women again, some who are sharing their most painful memories, others who are simply there providing support, and a whole batch of people that are offering theories and ideas. And I've really come to realize through this experience that this true crime community is a place where people, particularly and statistically women, can discuss and analyze cases together. It's a little safer environment, but they can really do what I've always found women are so good at doing, and that is to empathize and to embrace and build and strengthen. I don't know. What are your thoughts there, Joni?
I agree. I think the community has been a huge part of it. I mean, it really has this kind of this communal aspect to it that I think has become very powerful and was kind of unexpected. I mean, when I was growing up, it was, you read a book, you know, and you're kind of interested in that. And now, like I said, I mean, you can talk to somebody who was involved in that family to some extent, or a cousin, or, you know, we see these communities where, you know, they're huge and they have a huge impact. So, I mean, I feel like I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, but I think it's just really amazing at not, are women the main, true crime consumers, but how are they? How are they, you know, true crime consumers? I mean, how are they engaging with true crime? Is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? You know, where do we get that balance? So I think all those questions are so important, you know, to be answered.
I am so grateful that you took time to share your thoughts today with us. I not only deeply respect you, but I claim you as a friend. From a clinical perspective, for healthy minds and healthy perspectives on things, what advice would you give to listeners that dig into the true crime community?
That is a very interesting question and complicated question, because I do think it depends upon the motives that people have when they're, you know, when they're using them. You know, when they're listening to true crime, what is the motive for that? What is interesting for that? So that's kind of the first part of it. You know, is what do we mean we're talking about true crime? So what would be the other? So in terms of listening to true crime, and we talked about the balance already and how important it is to get that balance. You know, what is the purpose, I guess? I mean, you know, occasionally you see people who seem to be studying, you know, true crime for the worst possible motives. I mean, we don't want to forget that there is a very, very, very small percentage of people who study crime to get better at it, or to perpetrate, you know, something that would be really be horrible. So a lot of it is not so much, again, who has it, but what is it for and how is it used?
So here's a, I think, an interesting, challenging question, and that is, what advice would you give to people in relation to listening to what is out there in this incredible social environment regarding emotional theories versus factual information from the case?
I think it, you know, certainly do it in modulation, do it in moderation. I think that's definitely true. We're talking about consuming true crime content. Moderation, I think, is very, very important. So that's, I think, the very beginning part of it that we're talking about. You know, true crime? Why are we listening to so much true crime? Is it a good thing? I mean, the other part of it is starting to look at true crime ethics, which is another kind of whole new, not a whole new field, but something very, very important for us to talk about. So I think it's when we're talking about true crime to be aware of the pros and cons, the dangers and the opportunities, and be, I guess, also tuned in to how it is affecting you. You know, how there's certainly, I listen to way more than I probably should. I don't find it, I can't say that I've experienced personally it, you know, it bringing me down or making me depressed or whatever, but it's heavy material. It is heavy material, and it's important to have relationships with people who aren't, you know, in that same space necessarily. Exactly. So, it's something not to be taken lightly, and also to be aware of why, again, what all this stuff means to each person, I think is very important.
Well, thank you. And I want to, my last question is more of a comment that I'd love to have a response to, if you're willing to give that. One of the things that I have continued to pound as a drum is that law enforcement has to move into at least the last century when it comes to managing social media in criminal investigations, that social media is more than a Twitter account or a Facebook page in the police department, but that it is something where you embrace this true crime community and give them assignments that are safe to do. I think we saw it in the Delphi case when Indiana State Police finally came out and said, we're looking for this social media presence, anyone that's had contact with this Anthony Schatz, if you remember. They gave the public an assignment, and I suspect they got a response. Police have to evolve from this, we're not going to talk to anybody, to embracing the community.
I think that is absolutely huge. I mean, there has been kind of a lack of trust, I think, between law enforcement and the community. And I think that needs to be a huge shift. And I think we've seen that we need to find some kind of coming together. Some kind of come together between law enforcement and, you know, the public. I think to some extent, the citizen detective movement may have come out of this lack of trust or lack of feeling of respect, you know, from the official community. So I think there's some opportunity still that we have at
law enforcement could really embrace this community to do things. We've seen it with all of these divers that have popped up that are finding dead bodies that police have long given up hope that they can be recovered. I was really frustrated just yesterday. This young man in Idaho who fell into the water while fishing or while duck hunting and disappeared. The police, eventually the sheriff's office, the search and rescue, after a few days said, hey, it's just too dangerous and cold's coming in. The family didn't give up and the community didn't give up. And yesterday, volunteers found the body. And to me, that's a little bit embarrassing that it takes those kinds of resources to solve problems. And yet, why not embrace them and say, let's put them to work then and do it in a managed fashion. Folks, we've had the pleasure of listening to Dr. Joni Johnston, a clinical and forensic psychologist. Joni, tell people where they can follow you, how they can communicate with you if you want them to. And let's talk a little bit about books or anything else that you think they ought to know about.
Yeah, probably the easiest is my website, which is just drjonijohnston.com. That's pretty easy to remember. I write a blog for Psychology Today called The Human Equation. And then I published a book about a year ago called Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. It was a book I wrote. So there's lots of different ways to get a hold of me.
How about your Twitter handle or your X handle?
I've just now, it's embarrassing, kind of gotten to, Twitter or now X. So I just now started kind of, I've been doing so much LinkedIn for a long period of time, and I'm still trying to, I'm sure you are too, trying to juggle my practice as with the media stuff that I do. And so I'm a slow Twitter adopter.
we're going to put the website down below and make sure you check that out. And Joni, we really need to review the book and just talk about those high points so that people know. Maybe we could even do a online book signing of 5 or 6 books one night and let people buy them online, and we'll shoot them off if you're willing to do that.
I'd love that.
That'd be great. Well, my thanks to you. And you know what? I've interrogated you for 45 minutes here. Any question you got for me?
You have got so much wisdom, Mike. It would take me, I don't know how much to tap into that, but I absolutely.
Hot air blowing in the wind is what I have.
I loved being on your show. I was so flattered by the invitation, and I hope it's not the first time or last time.
Oh, no, many more. Many more. Thank you so much. Well, So let's stop there for a minute. That was a little bit of a marathon, so thanks for hanging in with me on that one. It's been really interesting to watch the conversation as it's going through. Wanted to give you a minute because actually have another really cool part, because I actually also interviewed an incredible award-winning journalist named Nancy Jo Sales to talk about one little area. I'm also going to follow up later with another video down the road on dating sites that predators use. And we'll talk about that in a little detail, but we'll see if any questions pop up here that I can answer. Otherwise, it looks like you're all having a great conversation amongst yourself. If you are not doing anything on Friday night, and if all the planets align, can you believe it? I've gone live twice in 1 week, but I might do 3 Friday night. I actually got an invitation, so I want to see what your comments are here. I got an invitation to stay in Warren Jeff's house out in Colorado City, Hilldale, where the FLDS polygamous group resides. Many of you know I spent a big piece of my career trying to put Mr. Jeff's in prison, and his bodyguard was my absolute nemesis. Nonetheless, Friday night, I'm going to stay in Warren Jeff's house out in Colorado City. And if the internet's good, I just may go live and wander around a little bit and talk a little bit. And then Saturday morning, I'm meeting a fellow out in that same area. And we're going to walk around. He grew up in that polygamous group. He was the son of the mayor. And many of you have watched him on the YouTube channel Growing Up in Polygamy. We have had a great relationship over the years. And we're going to go just wander around town and talk about things from his experiences growing up in the community, my experiences as a police officer trying to rescue children in that area. So we'll see what happens. If you haven't watched my videos on my return to Colorado City in the FLDS, go back and watch some of those, because they're kind of crazy. I call it my ghost stories tour. And there I went through and went to places like the baby cemetery and the secret caves where guns and explosives were stored, to the zoo. And I shared many of my thoughts, including meeting up with my long-term nemesis and talking about things that happened back then. So anyway, Friday night, we may go live. We may not. Who knows? Let's see. Jennifer Nobles says, I love it. I'm new here for the most part. I've seen Mike several times, but didn't get into the lives much. Oh, that's so kind of you, Jennifer. Thank you. I don't know. It might be really stupid. In fact, I chatted with Annie Elise this week, and I said, just do a good story if I end up not coming back from the community. So looks like I lost my camera there for a second, but I'm going to try to bring it back in. There we go. So let's see. Margaret has to say, that explains the weather systems hitting us one after another. Yeah, 19 bedrooms and counting. There's more than that. The place I'm going to be going to has a batch. Let's see. Ella says, my sister and I think we've discovered someone we know is in a cult and his kids are suffering. What do we do? So it's a pretty tough situation. Go back and listen to some of my videos on my series called Cults Among Us. We talk about those. You might self-plug, read my book, Deceived, an Investigative Memoir of the Zion Society Cult, where I talk about recruiting tactics in cults. And actually had a nice conversation yesterday in regard to cults. We might resurface a few things. So we'll continue going on. So anyway, maybe Friday night from Colorado City, we'll have a little chat. But let's jump back in now. And you know what? I don't even think I've gone this long for a really long time. So I came down to our little place down in southern Utah. I'm all alone. And so what else other than to talk with all of you? And before I stop here, I'm going to just say a shout out to Michelle, our in-house counsel, got COVID. Oh, man, Michelle. I'm so sorry to hear that. It is tough when you have COVID. So let's watch this, and I hope you'll keep weighing in. Thanks one more time to Dr. Johnston for taking time to share her comments on this topic. Make sure that you're checking her out at her website at Dr. Joni Johnston, STON.com. I'll put the link down below in the description area so that you can get there a little easier. Now, well, we've been talking about the reasons women are more prone to view true crime than men. You know, my final list of reasons has been evolving as I've studied this thing out a little more. As I lean on experts like Dr. Johnston, or as I talk to journalists, in fact, in my opinion, one of the reasons women may be more drawn to true crime is that you happen to have a heightened sense of empathy. Women are much better, oftentimes, at connecting emotionally with each other. You're better at connecting with the victims and, frankly, their families. This empathy makes these true crime stories more relatable to you. And this emotional connection can create a deeper level of engagement with the content. You know, I've also found that women are usually more analytical and detail-oriented in not only their discussions, but the way they live. True crime documentaries are like these intricate puzzles with challenging events that frankly challenge viewers to piece together the clues and to solve the mysteries. This analytical aspect may appeal more to women who enjoy the intellectual stimulation plus the thrill of trying to crack the case alongside the investigators. Now, I want to take a moment and just jump over to an interview with Nancy Jo Sells, an amazing journalist who I reached out to because of her ideas in regard to women, dating apps, and true crime. Let's do this.
Recently, I read a really interesting article in The Guardian by Nancy Jo Sells entitled, Why Do Women Love True Crime So Much? I have a theory. And to share that theory firsthand, I thought it would be fun to invite Nancy Jo Sells on to talk about it. Nancy, welcome to Profiling Evil.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. I've been looking at your work, and it's so interesting. And it links up with a lot of things that I'm interested in, too. So,
oh, well, that's good. Well, hopefully we'll have a fun conversation. I spent a law enforcement career investigating serial predators. And during COVID, my kids were so tired of me telling old cop stories. They said, why don't you tell one on YouTube? And somehow it seemed to resonate with our audience. So since then, we've been doing that. But let's talk about your article, because in that article, you share a number of theories around why women in particular are so attracted to these stories of serial killers and true crime. It's something that I've noted throughout my career as well, and statistically it proves out. But take a moment and share with our listeners why you think women are predominantly consumers of true crime information. And then let's kind of launch into a little bit of a discussion on what you think was missing in that research.
Well, my work is in the field of women and girls, tech and its effects on society, social media and its effects on kids and society, and also dating and the dating space and dating apps, which are, you know, very controversial and yet widely used, because the dating app companies have sort of taken over the way that people date. And yet they are not safe. And that's something that's borne out by lots of statistics and studies and just really common sense, which is that, you know, going on a date, being in a potentially, you know, intimate situation with someone that you really don't know and is not vetted by these companies and is a really kind of an unknown quantity is dangerous, you know? And so I think that is common sense. And I think that a lot of women who use dating apps are very well aware that they are potentially putting themselves in danger by going on a date with someone that they've never met before and that they've just met over the internet, you know? And it's not, it's not a really an original thought with me to say that they're dangerous. I mean, this is well known. People who use them know this. Women know it. And yet women use them, again, because it's become necessary if you want a date to kind of use these things, many people feel. So, you know, you have upwards of 40 million people in the United States using dating apps, right? So there's just millions and millions of people using these things. But you're meeting with a stranger, right? And I always say, and, you know, again, just common sense, if Ted Bundy were alive today, wouldn't he be finding victims on dating apps? Wouldn't he be on dating apps? Of course he would be. Because he wouldn't have to put himself out there and go into the parking lot and pretend to have a hurt arm and all the things that he did to get women to help him to his car and, you know, pull them into his car. He could just go on Tinder and meet up with someone at the bar. You know, he was a good looking guy. And that was part of his MO, was that he used his looks and his weird sociopathic charm to get people to be in intimate situations with him.
You know, what you're saying is really interesting to me from a profiling perspective, because we often talk about this idea of what the predator does. Years ago, I listened to a study on tracking the Arctic wolf as it moved around the tundra in the north. And as I watched and listened to this biologist explaining this, it struck me that these animal predators are very much like human predators. And it reminded me of a statement my grandfather made when I was a young boy and we were out fishing. And I said, what's the secret to catching fish? And he said, fish where there are fish. And so for a predator, yeah, looking at those sites is a place to look at someone who might let their guard down a little bit, might be a little more vulnerable to having a relationship, which might cause them to cast aside some of the risk that they recognize they might be facing by meeting someone. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that dating apps have become a tool for predators, and I've been writing about this for years. There has not been a lot of similar work done in mainstream media about this, and I find it really perplexing. Finally, people seem to be catching up. There was recently an article in, I think, Mother Jones, that was the title of which was How Dating Apps Became a Paradise for Predators, which is true. And I think that the dating app story, the online dating industry story, is also a crime story, because you have just, you know, so many crimes committed through these apps, which predators and other types of criminals, it's not just sexual offenders see as a tool. They see them as a tool to gain access to people, especially women. There are, you know, instances of sexual assault, instances of theft, romance scams, all of these things. I mean, you know, this is happening. So when you ask why are women so interested in true crime, which they've always been, it's not to say that dating apps created this interest in true crime, not at all. But I think that they have certainly fueled the interest in true crime, because what has happened is that you have, I read about women and girls and their concerns and their issues a lot of the time. I look at this from the perspective of women and girls. So you have, and from teenagers on up. So you see, you want to date. You have a dating pool that is a lot of it is, you learn how to vet yourself. You learn how to vet them yourself. And this is what a lot of women have learned how to do. They have become, and I've learned this through talking to them, through interviewing them, you know, hundreds of women and teenagers I've interviewed about dating over the last, say, 10 years or so. And, you know, I had one of the women that I interviewed said, she was a woman in her 30s, said, any of my friends, I mean, she was joking, but it's a telling quote. She said, any of my friends could immediately be hired by the FBI because they've learned how to find out about, you know, someone's history, someone's past, someone's job, where they come from, who they're, you know, do all kinds of things about someone before going on this date with a person who they don't really know very well. And so I started thinking about how women typically in the past, all the articles that we've seen about women and true crime and why are they so interested? And I read a lot of them say, well, because they're interested in it from the perspective of the victim, because they don't want to wind up a victim. That's true. And I think that that's also correct. But I think now also women are looking at true crime from the perspective of the detective and from law enforcement, because they're more putting themselves in the shoes of someone who needs to find out about this person, who needs to know whether this person is capable or has a history of criminal offenses. So that's pretty much what it is. And I don't think there's any great, you know, like mystery to it, or I don't think it's even that surprising of an insight on my part. I think it's something that I really heard from women themselves that I've talked to about it. You know, it's like, of course, we have to use the tools of the internet and social media to research these people so that we won't get killed, raped, robbed, etc. That's pretty much it.
No, I think this is fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of comments we end up with in the chat box and what the feelings are of the people that are listening. Again, our primary demographic is female on Profiling Evil. So it'll be interesting to see. I guess the question that I would have for you is, from your experience of researching this and writing about it, if someone isn't that budding FBI agent that knows how to search the web, where would you suggest they find more information out about that possible someone they're going to meet?
I don't think people should use dating apps. I mean, after years of investigating them and talking to people about them and talking to people who work at these companies and know, you know, seeing how the sausage is made, they're not safe. They're taking your money for something that really doesn't usually lead to very good results. They're designed to be addictive, and their primary goal is not actually to help you find love and marriage, which statistically they don't do overall. I mean, everybody can say, oh, but I know this person who got married off Tinder. That's anecdotal. That's not data. The data, which the only data we really have is from Pew Research, suggests that only about 10% of people are really finding long-term committed relationships, which most people want, men and women, that is what they want on these apps. So I think it's a scam, really. you know? And I say that, I don't feel that that's an irresponsible statement. I say that after years of looking into this and interviewing hundreds of people, once again, making a documentary film about it called Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age, which was on HBO for 5 years. Now it's available on Amazon, Prime Video, other sites. And it's just like, it's just, these companies are not interested in helping you find love and they put you in danger. So I don't personally think that people should use dating apps. I don't think that they are a good thing for our society. I think they're leading to a lot of dysfunction and unhappiness and an emotional upset. You know, also just once people are on them, there's all kinds of harassment that occurs and, you know, sort of unflattering comments, the sending or of non-consensual nudes. I mean, it's really kind of a cesspool. And once again, you really don't know who you're getting on them because they don't vet, because it's too expensive for them to vet. So I don't think people should use dating apps.
Well, you can catch my entire interview with Nancy Jo Sales by listening to this on Profiling Evil Podcasts. That's the audio version. Or by watching my video that's coming up called Dating Apps, Truly True Crime. Now, I hope y'all might weigh in below on the reasons that you pay such close attention to true crime stories. Remember that you can always contact me at my email, profilingevil@gmail.com. You know, my thoughts have evolved quite a bit as I've worked through this video, as I've listened to viewers like Deborah, Joanne, and Candace, and thanks again for weighing in. And as I've interviewed experts like Dr. Joni Johnston and journalist Nancy Jo Sales. And with that, I want to take time and share five primary reasons why I think women are more interested in true crime than men. You know, among the avid enthusiasts of this genre out there, women stand out as a significant demographic. They're more drawn to the mysteries, the suspense, the psychological intricacies that these true crime narratives offer to us. Women are multifaceted, and they have multifaceted reasons behind why they're attracted to true crime. But I think it boils down to five main reasons. First is their inherent fascination. This fascination we all have with human behavior, but women seem to be more interested. One of the primary reasons women are drawn to true crime stories lies in their innate curiosity about human behavior. You seem to be more interested instead of trying to be interesting. True crime narratives often delve into the minds of criminals, exploring their motives, their thought processes, and the complex interplay of factors that drive these individuals to commit heinous acts. For many women, this exploration serves as a means to better understand the darker facets of human psyche. It offers a glimpse into the motivations that may be difficult to really comprehend in normal, everyday lives. Now, the second reason I believe that women are attracted to true crime is because women appear to have a unique ability to empathize and to connect with victim stories. Women are often seen as more empathetic, goes without saying in many cases, and they find themselves connected emotionally and many other ways with victims that are portrayed in true crime stories. By empathizing with the victims, women engage with the stories on a personal level. They have this feeling and sense of compassion and shared humanity. This connection can be a driving force behind the fascination they have for it. It can heighten the emotional stakes and it creates a deeper involvement in the narrative. Now, the third reason is that I think women are empowered through awareness. True crime stories, in many cases, shed light on the real-world dangers that women face. It sheds real light knowledge about the importance of personal safety. Women who have faced societal challenges or felt vulnerable at times find empowerment in educating themselves about the potential risks that are out there. The awareness generated through the true crime narratives can be seen as a tool for self-defense, enabling women to navigate the world with a heightened sense of caution and preparedness. Now, number four is interesting to me. That is that women experience a cathartic and emotional release when they look at true crime cases. Engaging with these true crime stories provides this cathartic experience for many, many women. The emotional roller coaster of fear, suspense, and relief offers a controlled outlet for stress and anxiety. And through the vicarious experience of crime solving, women can navigate this range of emotions in a really safe environment, satisfying that human need for suspense, that human need for resolution without real-world consequences. And my fifth reason is all about the social connection and the community bond that occurs when women are reviewing these cases. I watch it in the chat below. True crime has become a shared cultural experience, fostering communities of enthusiasts who discuss, analyze, and dissect these cases together. For women, this communal aspect provides an opportunity for social connection and bonding. Whether it's done through an online forum like this, a podcast like this, or book clubs, women seem to engage in collective exploration of these mysteries, and that helps them share their perspectives, build a sense of camaraderie, and connect with like-minded individuals. The attraction of women to true crime stories is a complex interplay of psychological, social, and cultural factors. The genre offers a window into the human psyche, a platform for empathy, a source of empowerment, and a cathartic experience, and a means in which there can be this social connection. As women continue to engage with true crime narratives, the genre is going to evolve. It's going to reflect and shape the cultural perceptions of crime, justice, and the human experience. I really hope you've enjoyed this video, folks. If you have, I hope you'll make sure to hit the like and subscribe button, click on the like button, and please tell all your friends. And remember, we really would appreciate it if you subscribe to Profiling Evil and go over and check out Dr. Joni Johnston's website. You can also check out Nancy Jo's websites, and the links are down below. I want to thank both of them for the information that they provided in this particular video, as well as our Profiling Evil channel members, Deborah, Joanne, and Candace. Thank you so much. Now remember, you can find Profiling Evil on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you can always get it here on YouTube.
Hey everybody, look who I'm hanging out with. And listen, I'm not attending choir practice, but I just wanted to tell you that you need to be watching Profiling Evil YouTube. Don't miss it. I'm telling you, there's something there for you every single time. I never miss. You shouldn't either.
Remember that you can get Profiling Evil's audio podcasts on your favorite podcast platform.
I was victimized at one point. When I left the police department, I went to work for the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and at that time, I was assaulted, and my police background kicked in, and I turned around and kicked the guy, and basically, that's how the police caught him, and then he told one of the other guy, and they were able to convict them of attempted rape and attempted statutory.
Nothing happened to me, so I've never been a victim of crime.
So, yes, I have been a victim of a violent crime when I was in my early 20s. And that episode made me very afraid at first, and my being afraid got a little more to being mad when I felt like I'd been victimized with the court system during the trial. I felt like I was on trial, and so my being afraid kind of lessened because I was angry about things. The perpetrator was convicted, but received an extremely light sentence for the crime. But I use this awareness of the awareness of the fact that these things go on to be less afraid. And after seeing that an individual could make a difference, my awareness of crime deepened. And again, down that rabbit hole of true crime started.
And the lessons I learned by watching the crime shows is what not to do to keep from getting caught and what not to do, period, because I don't want to go to jail. So I don't want to do anything that's going to be illegal. So
watching true crime, the big one is, and from my two friends that happened to, is never ever let anyone take you to that second location, you know, make you stand and fight where you are.
The primary lesson I have learned from watching true crime and being a partaker of various ways of watching true crime, has made me aware of how important it is to be alert in all situations. And certainly your YouTube channel emphasizes that, and I've done your academy, and it emphasizes how important it is to be aware of all situations. But my involvement in partaking of true crime through all the different venues has really made me even more aware of that. I try not to be hyper-vigilant, but consistently vigilant, and just to stay aware at all times. I try to spread the words to family and friends about how important it is to be aware of the people in their lives and all the situations that they get put in and put themselves in. And especially some of the younger folks in my life, I've tried to point that out, being a grandmotherly type of person. So that's what I've learned most from my delving into true crime.
So thanks for joining us on this investigative journey. Until the next time, stay curious, and we'll keep solving these mysteries together. We'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truthfinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truthfinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.